This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation, please visit our website at zmm.mro.org/donate. Thanks for your support.
For Master Hong Zhur, vast and far-reaching, without boundary, secluded and pure, manifesting light, this spirit is without obstruction. Its brightness does not shine out, but can be called empty and inherently radiant. Its brightness, inherently purifying, transcends causal conditions beyond subject and object. Subtle, but preserved, illumined and vast, also it cannot be spoken of as being or non-being, or discussed with images or calculations. Right in here, the central pivot turns, the gateway opens. You accord and respond without laboring and accomplish without hindrance. Everywhere, turn around freely, not following conditions, not falling into classifications. Facing everything, let go and attain stability. Stay with that just as that. Stay with this just as this. That and this are mixed together with no discriminations as to their places. So it is said that the earth lifts up the mountain without knowing the mountain's stark steepness, that a rock contains jade without knowing the jade's flawlessness. This is how truly to leave home, how home leaving must be embodied. On Wednesday, I spoke about samadhi, or tranquility, calming the mind, this essential aspect of Buddhist meditation. And today I wanted to talk about insight, seeing into self nature, seeing directly. And I spoke of before about how both of these aspects are what makes Buddhist meditation Buddhist meditation. That in any in all of the schools of Buddhism in which meditation plays a central role, this is so. And it's presented in the very beginning by the Buddha as two of the three trainings, along with morality. And so these three aspects together are what we mean when we say practice. So when you think of practicing Zazen or liturgy or work or a relationship, being in the world, turning inward, those three aspects are present, need to be present. And I mentioned on Wednesday that often when I speak of morality in this context, that I speak of it as compassion. And of course, that's part of it, but really morality in these three trainings is what you do with your mind, your thoughts, words, and actions. It's our behavior, our morality, the way we conduct ourselves in such a way that is either creating, continuing to create negative karma, agitate the mind, create remorse and regret, and make calming the mind very, very difficult. And so that's one of the reasons that morality in Buddhism is so important. Obviously for its own sake, and so that we're not bringing suffering to others. In terms of our Zazen, it's critical because unless we are living in a way that is conducive to the way itself, the mind will not calm, because we'll constantly be recreating disturbances and upset within our mind by virtue of what we're doing. Vast and far-reaching, without boundary. Right in here, the central pivot turns and the gateway opens. And this is in a sense, the simplicity, the basic nature of our consciousness, and it's also the great mystery of insight. Samadhi and prajna. Why are both of these important? Why isn't just calming the mind, developing samadhi, bringing to rest the waves of thought and emotion? You know, it's our emotional turbulence that is considered the most difficult, the most challenging of all our obstructions. You know, thoughts come and go. They have power, but they're, you know, they have object-like nature. We see them, we understand them, because their whole purpose is to convey understanding and meaning. And although we get seduced by them, and they can be very powerful, both in a negative and a positive way, in the scheme of things, they're relatively easy to let go of. Emotions are different. They're embodied in a different way. They're not so object-like, not so cogent. Although they're communicating a great deal, sometimes, oftentimes, that can be unclear to us. And even when it is clear, still, they're not so easy to let go of, such as a thought. When an emotion takes up residence within you, it's not just a matter of deciding to let that go, and then it goes away, it drops away, as is can be true with a thought. And so, but nevertheless, given how agitated, how turbulent they can be, and of course the way to the remedy, if you will, of this emotional turbulence is not to be non-emotional. It's not to cut them off or suppress them. That's just creating more agitation. So we have to learn how to work with them very well, skillfully. But why isn't calming the mind sufficient? Why isn't tranquility sufficient? Given, as I spoke about yesterday, and as you know, most people experience in their zazen, how profound that can be within you when you experience that settling. Why isn't that enough? So an old master said, the mind of an ordinary sentient being is always in a state of turbulence. Unless we train it to rest in tranquility meditation, it will be impossible to uproot our mental conflicts. However, if we only practice samadhi and neglect gaining insight, we will also have trouble. Samadhi may suppress our emotional conflicts or calm them and give us some control over them, but it will not uproot those conflicts. There will still be underlying unconscious processes that have not been dealt with that will prevent our liberating ourselves from the anguish of birth, old age, and death. And so in a sense, samadhi is very conditional. As most people experience all too well during Sesshin, when you go home and you enter back into your own fray and you see how that calm that you have established during Zazen begins to slip away, right? And you can't preserve it. You can't hold on to it. And so as true and valid and profound as it can be, it's also conditional on living a life of mindfulness and awareness, on practicing regularly your zazen, on doing sesshin. And one of the reasons sesshin is so important is because within our daily practice, as essential as that is, we develop, you know, certain patterns. And while we can continue to develop our practice within our daily studies, it's a shin that takes us beyond what we do on a daily basis, obviously, because we're sitting a great deal more. And so in that, it opens that door. It sort of drops out the bottom. And we can experience, go much further and experience more of our actual capacity. And that establishes, not only does that have an effect in the moment, but it also establishes a confidence, right? It helps us to build confidence in our capacity to practice and in the capacity of our mind to settle to such depths and degrees. And that confidence we then take back to our daily practice, not to try and create or recreate or preserve it, but just knowing that we have that depth of capacity because you've tasted that. And that, just having that experience and having that confidence, allows you to sit in a different way, to sit more deeply, to sit with more confidence. Whereas when you don't have that experience, then your zazen is really based on just all that you know, all that you have known. And so as that experience continues to deepen and broaden, what you bring to your cushion is a direct sense, a direct experience of what your capacity is. And as that keeps happening, that sense of limitlessness, of boundlessness in terms of your own ability in your zazen and in your practice continues to expand. And it's just a beautiful self-reinforcing process. But having said all of that, as this teacher says, there will still be underlying unconscious processes that we have not yet dealt with, or that are still just very strong. That the samadhi that we have may calm in those moments when our mind is very still, when we're practicing well, but they're still there. The roots are still there, which means they can very easily or quickly be brought to the surface again in certain situations. Now the teacher says, if we practice tranquility meditation, and by that he means, you know, the meditation I spoke of Wednesday, the meditation that all of us are practicing, which is basically just settling the mind. If we practice this alone, we will only put our mental processes into a temporary suspension. They will never be dissolved completely. And this is so because insight has not yet been born in us. We still have various latent defilements that need to be removed. And so it's kind of a nice way of putting it, that things are in temporary suspension. In the sense that they're not so much right on the surface, which is where our reactivity takes place. But they're softened, they're sort of dropped back, suspended, so that we're able to be more spacious, more expansive, less reactive. But it's a temporary suspension, and that's really the key here. It's through the process of tranquility meditation that we learn to work with our emotional conflicts. It's through the development of insight that we learn to dissolve them at their unconscious origin. Tranquility meditation makes the mind unshakable. Insight makes it as unmovable as a mountain. And so here, these teachers are making clear why both of these aspects of our meditation are important and need to be practiced. Trungpa Rinpoche said in his characteristic style, "Meditation practice is based on the idea of being yourself, as you are, something you have rarely done. All along, you've had problems with that. Even at an early age, you tried to please your world. You tried to please your mommy and daddy. If you had, sometimes you got angry with your parents, but you never made a relationship with yourself. Instead, you created a kind of emotional insulation, which became more and more prominent as you grew from a teenager to an adult. And now you're continuously insulated. You carry that insulation with you in your timid smile and timid aggression. Such timidity, shyness, and uncertainty represent what we speak of as passion, aggression, and delusion. Because of that insulation, you've never experienced real life. You've not yet really learned to be with yourself, although you might have experienced a glimpse of such a possibility in an intensive retreat. However, having recognized this fact, you also discover that your existence is workable. Your timidity, uncertainty, and fear can be worked with by means of your sitting practice. And this is really a key thing to understand, is that because of our nature, that even though these tendencies can be very deep and difficult to really resolve, dissolve, and see through, and bring into harmony with how we think and act and speak, even though all of that's true, at every moment, no matter what state we find ourselves in, and no matter what circumstances we find ourselves in, Buddhism's understanding of our nature is that things are always inherently workable. It's just another way of saying you can always practice. The practice is always available to you, no matter how intractable, entrenched, dark, you know, difficult things may seem. That's our view, right? That's how we're seeing it. Things themselves, we ourselves, are always workable. And that's an incredible thing to know. It's an incredible thing to have faith in. That's, in a sense, what taking refuge is. Taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and Sangha is taking refuge in your fundamental ability to be workable. That's also the source of our compassion, because we realize everyone's like that. Everyone's workable. No matter how intractable they may seem, no matter how uninterested they may seem in working it out, right? And there are lots of people who seem distinctly uninterested in bringing out their own brightness. But that doesn't change a bit the fact that they are workable, they themselves, and at every moment. That's why bodhisattvas don't get depressed for too long. They do get overwhelmed at times. Think of Avalokiteshvara's head exploding. Right? That was such a moment. But not for too long. Because in that moment, when things seem overwhelming, we're really retreating back to that old place where we think things are not workable. I mean, that's what being overwhelmed is. But a bodhisattva doesn't dwell there. And pretty quickly, they turn back around and realize things are workable. I can enter this. And so our calming of the mind calms these restless waves of thoughts and emotions. It's insight that overturns the basis of our false views, of our faith in our false views. That's the ultimate transformation. That transforms something from being in suspension but still present to being essentially seen through. It's with insight that we see, as the Buddha said, things are not as they seem. It's with realization that we understand to be attached to things is illusion. It's with realization that we understand that all things are a result of our clinging to our unreal mental constructions, but not as words. It's with insight that as you chant the Heart Sutra, you realize you're chanting your experience, your understanding. They're no longer the words of the Buddha. Samadhi and this calming of the mind can also be a trap, of course, because it's seductive, because it is enjoyable. It is. And it's self-affirming, right? That you understand that it is true and good. And so in that way, it can become a kind of a cave that we seek. In fact, most people, I would venture to say, in the beginning of practice, are seeking peace within samadhi. Whether they have the language for it or not, they're seeking a peace within their meditation that is, in essence, an escape from the turbulence of their lives. And with time and studying the Dharma, we realize that there's more. There has to be more than that. And that self-affirming that takes place within practice, within the development of samadhi, with insight, is very, very important. There is a self-affirmation where you see something and you know that it's true. However, that too, of course, can be a trap in the sense that we just be self-affirming and that sometimes what we're affirming is our delusion. Right? We experience something or we see something and we think this is Dharma and it's really our delusion. And so that's why that necessary and natural process of self-affirmation has to be joined with study, with the Dharma itself. That's what training is about. That's what studying with a teacher is about. Is so that we're able to, in a sense, check our own sense of what's happening, our own sense of what's true with the teachings, with the teacher, so that we can understand, is this true? Or am I kidding myself? Am I fooling myself? Right? Because there are so many ways we can fool ourselves. And we can do that wanting to. You know, in other words, we can want to fool ourselves. We can want to just, you know, believe that we're enlightened. Or we can do it in a sense in a more innocent way. We're practicing, we're sincere, we're not trying to, you know, become the next Buddha. But we have experiences that we don't know quite how to understand them. And that's why training is always important. Hongzhou says this: the brightness, and this brightness is what we realize. And brightness is just a word, right? So it doesn't mean we should go looking for a bright light. It's a way of describing something which is inherently indescribable. And yet, it is a brightness. He says it's brightness inherently purified because what is realized is the illusory nature of every obstacle, the illusory nature of our suffering. Transcends causal conditions beyond subject and object. We see into the nature of our karma. We see it's a fundamental nature as empty. Thoughts, desires, intentions, words, actions, consequence. We also see that cause and effect is real. The two truths. And in seeing this, the emptiness of all things, that to be obstructed is an illusion. Where is the obstruction? Can you find it? Does it exist apart from you or anything? Does it exist inherently in anything? In other words, is anything in the world or in your body and mind inherently obstructed or obstructing? And yet, even when we see this directly, attachments persist. These underlying tendencies persist. We still act as though things have separate identities, as though they have their own power. their own being. And this is very important to understand. That even though now there's some direct understanding, we still grasp. We're still reactive. But if that understanding is clear, sufficiently clear, we see that in our grasping, that we're grasping an empty space. We see that as we're constructing something, that we're painting a face on a cloud. As we do that. And it can be difficult to understand, how can that be? If you see what's true, then how does that realization not instantly clarify and purify all of your actions? And that's just our not yet understanding how deep these tendencies go. It's a little bit like having a house. You know, the Buddha spoke of the self as a house where the, you know, as you practice, the beams and the rafters start shaking. And Mara comes out of the basement and says, "What the hell's going on? Who's messing with my house?" And so Mara comes after you, right? Not happy about this, not one bit, right? And tries to get you to stop this foolishness. And so there are lots of teachings about how that takes place. And I'm trying to get you to stop taking this house apart. In insight and realization, the roof, the ceiling, the foundations crumble. But the plumbing and the wiring is still intact. So there's still energy flowing through those old wires. Water's still coming through. And so there's still life in this old house. And that can be, you know, the fact of this, just the basic, simple fact of this can be disconcerting or disappointing, because it seems like, you know, in so many of the teachings and the koans, you know, the student asks a question, the teacher responds, the student has a realization. Dot, dot, dot. And the implication is that the student goes on and lives their happy, free, unhindered life, right, with never another concern. Right? But in actual fact, that koan, each of those koans is just presenting you with one moment within a continuum of practice and study, in which there's continual raising of the buddhi mind, studying the Dharma, practicing more deeply, gaining understanding, deepening your samadhi, and then integrating that. And then raising the buddhi mind, studying the Dharma, deepening your samadhi and insight, integrating, and on and on. That's why training goes on essentially for a lifetime. That's why there are so many koans in the koan way of training in our tradition. And so when we train in both calming the mind and insight, we're continually being brought to this basic reality. In a sense, the house has to collapse over and over and over and over and over. The mind has to be brought to stillness over and over and over. But every time, all along the way, it's not the same. There's a sense of continuity, but it's not the same. Because your practice continually is developing and deepening your capacity to not just sit within samadhi, but to live within samadhi. And every awakening that you have, every insight that you have, is continuing to brighten the space. You know, Dada Roshi used to speak of it as, you know, you look out on a foggy morning and you see something across the meadow on the other side. And you can see that it's an animal, but you can't quite tell. Is it a deer? Is it a cow? Is it a moose? What is it? Right? But there's something there. You see it. And then as you continue training, that that becomes more and more clear. You see it in more and more definition, more understanding. But from the very beginning, it was there in its complete perfection. That what's realized in a small insight is what's realized in a deep insight, or in many subsequent insights through the course of training. It's the same nature, but it's seen and experienced and understood at a deeper and deeper and deeper level, which means more embodied. And so that's why we chant every noon service, to realize the absolute is not yet enlightenment. Hakuin speaks of this. He's speaking in terms of the five ranks of the relationship between the relative and the absolute, between our ordinary experience of the world and the fundamental nature of things. But we could also think of this in a sense in terms of samadhi and insight. And so making that translation, he says, therefore, as long as you remain in this hiding place of quietude, of calming the mind, of passivity and vacantness, where inside and outside seem calm and clear, and your understanding seems clear. He says, the moment the bright insight or the samadhi that you have developed comes into contact with differentiations, defiling conditions of turmoil and confusion, agitation and vexation, love and hate, you will find yourself helpless before them. And all the miseries of existence will press in upon you. And so in this case, I would say it's not that you're rendered helpless, because you can draw upon that samadhi. You can draw upon that more calm state of mind and body, because samadhi doesn't just reside in your mind. It's not just a result of the falling away of thoughts, but it's the whole body is being calmed. That's why working with your energy and your relaxation and your tension is so important. You calm the mind by letting fall away those streams of thought. You calm the body by bringing calmness and no conflict to the tension, the agitation, the pain, the holding, the gripping that you experience in your body. We have to work together in this. We have to be working together, body and mind. It's just not good understanding to think that if you just let go of your thoughts and your body is like a tightly coiled, you know, wire, that that's somehow going to bring you to a state of samadhi and peace. It's not. Right? More likely is that the thoughts are just being suppressed and the whole thing just becomes a sort of wound up volcano waiting to erupt. So we have to be working all together as one body and mind. The obstructions to this, the teachings say, are dullness, which is defined as a heaviness of mind and body whereby both become unserviceable. I like that. So as the mind and body become very heavy in our dullness, and in this state, both body and mind become very unserviceable. You can't access them. They're not working for you. Right? They're like dead weight at best. More often, they're much more active pressures and tightness and confinement. So this dullness is such an important part of cultivating both samadhi and insight, because it's just a, you know, it's kind of a default place we go. It's just part of human consciousness to become dull. And I don't know what it was like, you know, or is like for people who live very close to the earth, who live, you know, as more as our ancestors did. You know, where there's a much closer relationship to what I do and my survival. you know, in our civilized ways, we've been removed from a lot of that. Right? Our lives have literally been made much more safe in all kinds of ways, so that we can drive down the road in a 3-ton weapon, right, at 80 miles an hour and get to our destination and not remember how we got there. I mean, think about that. It's extraordinary. On one hand, you could say it's extraordinary function of our habit, right? But God forbid something get in the way, something unexpected, because predicated within that dullness is the sense that I'm in control. I know what's going to happen. I can go to sleep here because I've done this route many times before. Nothing happens between here and there, right? And that's just fooling ourselves into thinking that today is like yesterday. It doesn't take much to upset that. And so dullness is something that we need to be always attentive to, right? Particularly during session, where the ongoing nature of the zazen, right, can engender a state of dullness. Another teacher said it's like stepping into darkness and suddenly closing your eyes, you're becoming blind. Your mind becomes completely foggy and you lose your perceptiveness. In other words, the acuity, the sharpness of your senses is lost. Everything just becomes dull and opaque. Now, obviously, in such a state of mind, there will be no insight because we're in a fog. Insight arises most often out of samadhi because there's clarity, there's sharpness, there's vividness. We're completely present. And everything is completely present. There is no veil. There is nothing in between. Another obstacle is, the teachings speak of is being in a stupor, which they describe really as just being in a state of intense preoccupation, where we're just kind of stuck. Right? The wheels are turning. We're mulling over something. There's a kind of dull state to that. It's not mindful, right? It's repetitive, it's habitual. We're sort of running on automatic. And there's a kind of a blah state. So again, these are the obstacles to having insight. In the faith mind, it says, when no discriminating thoughts arise, the old mind, stupor, dullness, habitual, ceases to exist. When thought objects vanish, the thinking subject vanishes. As when the mind vanishes, objects vanish. Object is object only because of the subject. Subject is subject only because of the object. Understand the relativity of these two and their basic reality, emptiness. In this emptiness, the two cannot be found, and each contains in itself the whole world. If you don't discriminate between coarse and fine, you will not be tempted to prejudice an opinion. And here he means a biased view. So our minds, which are wired to differentiate between things that are different, but our conditioned mind adds meaning to those prejudices, to that discriminating consciousness. And in that meaning, we establish a sense of right and wrong, of self and other, and their suffering. And so when Hongzhi speaks about, when he says, right in this place, the central pivot turns and the gateway opens, not falling into conditions or classifications, that all things are unified with no discrimination as to their places. That in our conceptual awareness, we access what is conceptual. So in the upper levels of consciousness, eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, and I consciousness, the self-making consciousness, that's, in a sense, the realm we're practicing in when we practice. thoughts arise, emotions arise, you see them, you discern whether they're wholesome or not, you let them go. This is where practice occurs. And there is gaining insight within this realm. If you think of insight as the whole spectrum of seeing what has not been seen before, of revealing what was that moment before hidden, that is revealing something to you about your mind, about karma, the nature of impermanence, the nature of suffering, selflessness, liberation. And so whether that insight is more sitting on the surface, but it is revealing something new, or whether it's very, very deep and deeply transformative, it's all really within the realm of insight. But in Buddhism, this is all related to self-nature, understanding self-nature. But what we can't access through our wakeful mind when there's subject and object is that deepest level of our consciousness, the oceanic storehouse, where all of the seeds of our karma reside, where every experience is present. That our practice is continually affecting that level of our consciousness, which you can't touch. And that when we continue to spin our webs of greed, anger, and delusion, then that gives rise to bearing fruit of our karmic actions that appears as suffering. And further being bound and further being entangled and more distraction and more dullness, more stupor, and so on. But when we are practicing well, practicing loving kindness, compassion, generosity, patience, mindfulness, that's strengthening other seeds within that deepest level of consciousness. And that arises in our awareness in moments of insight as understanding. And that can happen in a realm that is conceptual, where there's still self and other, there's still self-awareness, and yet they're seen, and you know that you're seen. And so in practicing the breath, when you're aware of the breath, in a sense, that is a concept. The breath, it has a name. We call it that. You're aware of it. It has certain qualities. And as you practice in that realm, you gain some understanding about yourself, about the nature of your thoughts, your habit patterns, past karma, and so on. As you come closer and closer into being the breath, as you merge into the breath is no longer a concept. You have entered into the non-conceptual realm of breath, into the non-conceptual realm of phenomena, where the phenomena that we call breath is no longer phenomena. The same is true of a koan. When a student holds a koan, a question, what is mu? What is your original face? What is the meaning of Buddha Dharma? And Zhaozhou says, cypress tree in the garden. So when you hold that question, you hold mu, you hold the cypress tree in your mind, whether it's a word, whether it's a question, whether it's an embodied image. It's a concept, right? It's something that you're doing with your mind. And I used to really wonder about that in my early years of koan, because I thought, but I'm just using my mind to bring forth this phenomena, right? An object. So in a sense, I'm creating something in my mind. How is that liberating, right? Because this is conditioned existence. How is that not dukkha? Well, in a sense, it is. But that's what we can do within our zazen, within this realm of our consciousness. But it's not over, right? That's just the beginning. And so then as the student holds that question, holds that image, holds mu and becomes mu, lets go of the self into that koan so that they can no longer be found. Subject and object vanish, merge. Then there is no, they're no longer in the realm of the conceptual. They're no longer bringing forth phenomena. Because all things are non-dual. So whatever we might bring forth in our mind, whether it's heaven or hell, whether it's enlightenment or delusion, its nature is both conceptual and beyond concept. And so practice and gaining insight is there are moments where there is, in a sense, conceptual insight, which is valid, and then there are moments in which there can be a deliberateness to the way that you're bringing your awareness to your practice that helps to bring that forth in terms of seeing the impermanence of what's arising, seeing the suffering in what's arising. But in moving past that into what is we speak of as non-conceptual, it's no longer deliberate. It's no longer in your control. That's the place, the central, where the central pivot turns and the gateway opens. You cannot control it. And yet everything that your practice is making that possible. And it's that letting go into that central place where the pivot turns that is so important. That's what letting go of the witness is about. That's what letting go of the watcher is about. It's not only because that's a key way in which we reify the sense of self, but it's because that's what keeps us tethered to this realm of knowing. And it's hard to let go of that, because that's the world we know, because that's the nature of that world, is to know it. It's also where we feel like we are in control. And so we have to gain enough trust to let go of that, to enter into that central pivot turning, the gateway open. What Dogen speaks of is the inner chamber, where we hear an unrecognized voice. All metaphors and images not to be taken literally. They're just poetic ways, but true ways of speaking about something that is inexpressible. It cannot be spoken of as being or non-being. Is it real? Is it unreal? Is it existing? Is it not existing? For something to exist, it has to have objective reality. Subject and object have to be present. It has to exist on its own. But then why is it? When the mind is in tranquility, when the mind is not stirring, that subject and object merge. Not because you have controlled your mind to eradicate that object, but because your mind is no longer sustaining that object, nor the subject. In other words, what is when your mind actually comes full to rest, when it is no longer creating? And so it is said that the earth lifts up the mountain without knowing the mountain's stark steepness. A rock contains jade without knowing the jade's flawlessness. So having faith in Buddha nature, you, the mountain, you, the jade, need to establish enough faith and trust and experience such that you cannot know how steep you are, how majestic this mountain is. You cannot know how lustrous this jewel is. You're not looking for that. And yet the mind of inquiry, the mind that wants to understand, that wants to see into the nature of things, is absolutely critical. If we don't want to understand, then our sitting will become dull and passive, right? Then we will tend to make a nest in our samadhi. And that's why these two aspects are so important. That's why Teisho is often asked more questions than answer them. is to rouse that questioning mind, to encourage us to bring forth our own aspiration, to want to understand. And not so that we then establish and hold something that we're seeking in front of us. Don't do that. In fact, that's what the koan student has to learn, is how do you deeply want to understand, to penetrate that koan, to realize it is your own body and mind, and hold nothing in front of you. As you bring that koan into mind, that you establish it as a point of concentration, not as an expectation, not as a goal, not as a thing. And that's training. Because we're so goal, process to goal oriented. And whatever our practice is, that's true. And so to give a talk like this, I know for a lot of people rouses, sometimes agitates, sometimes makes people feel insecure, right, about insight. Do I have any? Have I had any? Am I going to have any? When is this going to happen? How will I know? Is it better than the next guy? All of that shit, right? Which is pretty much what that is. It's the stuff we've been fed and that, you know, functions in a matter of speaking with whole heap loads of suffering. But that's what we've been groomed in. That's what we've been trained to trust. And that's why it's a long and patient path, because we have to, not just by will or decision, we have to learn, to establish, to embody the capacity to deeply hunger for understanding, to pull out those roots, those deep roots, and to do that without grasping. And that's something that no one is ever going to figure out. You have to do it. You have to experience it. And so trust your practice. As Hongshu said, this is how we leave home. The home of our suffering, the home of that house, which is not a true place to live. And so understand that this is your zazen. This is your practice. And in the beginning, necessarily, we need to be very much aware of and practicing that tranquility of mind, calming the mind. But even at the beginning, to understand that you are seeing what arises in your mind. You are seeing those thoughts. You're seeing those emotions. That's important. Don't just rush past. Don't dwell in them. Don't perpetuate them, but see them. That's the beginning of gaining insight. That's the shifting of your mind from dullness to brightness. It's an extraordinary path that is so simple, and because of that, is so deep and so profound. And the implications of this are literally and by nature unimaginable. And it's all you. It's all you.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.mro.org.